Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with remarks by Senator Elizabeth Warren one day after declaring her candidacy for president at a campaign rally in Iowa on Sunday that, quote, by the time we get to 2020, Donald Trump may not even be president. She went on to say, in fact, he may not even be a free person. Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell Law School who recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act, joins us to discuss the launch of Elizabeth Warren's campaign, which Trump has greeted with racist disdain, tweeting his usual insult, calling her Pocahontas. But this time, Trump added, "See you on the campaign trail, Liz," with the word trail in caps, which some interpret as an allusion to the genocidal Trail of Tears in the 1800s carried out against Native Americans by Andrew Jackson, who Donald Trump has often praised, having placed a portrait of him in the Oval Office, as well as making a pilgrimage to Jackson's tomb in Tennessee after being sworn in. And since Robert Hockett is now an economic advisor to Congresswoman Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, we'll also talk about the Green New Deal, which Robert defended on Fox News in a heated exchange with Tucker Carlson, who was quoting passages from an earlier draft, which is no longer even a footnote, but has become a key right-wing talking point. Then we'll speak with an expert on the Middle East, Dr. Alon Ben-Meir, a professor and senior fellow at New York University Center for Global Affairs and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. He joins us to discuss the role of Saudi Arabia, which Jeff Bezos pointed to in his recent blog, accusing the parent company of the National Enquirer of extortion and its head David Pecker of being apoplectic at the mention of Saudi Arabia, writing, "For reasons still to be better understood, the Saudi angle seems to hit a particularly sensitive nerve." We'll also discuss why Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu are covering up for the Saudi Crown Prince in spite of international condemnation of MBS's role in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Then, finally, we'll get an analysis of the current situation in Iran on today's 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, which brought in the theocratic government that is now under increased sanctions from the Trump administration, whose National Security Advisor John Bolton recently ordered the Pentagon to develop a war plan for a future confrontation with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Abbas Milani, a director of Iranian studies at Stanford University, who taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, joins us to discuss the gap between the social changes since the revolution and the rigid moral strictures Iran's leaders still impose. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell Law School and a fellow at the Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, and the Occupy Cooperative. And he recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and is currently an economic advisor to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and helped write the Green New Deal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Hockett.
Hi, Ian. So good to be with you again. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Robert. And as you probably noticed from the introduction, there's quite a lot to talk about here in terms of Elizabeth Warren. She launched her campaign on Saturday, and that was in Lawrence, Kansas, in front of an old mill that was the site of a major labor action, wasn't it? Maybe 100 years ago? How long ago? I don't remember.
Indeed, it was quite a while ago. Lawrence, Kansas has other significance as well. It's named after Lawrence, Massachusetts, and it was actually founded by, in effect, abolitionist pilgrims from Lawrence, Massachusetts, who migrated en masse over to Kansas after the passage of the Kansas and Nebraska Act, I think it was in 1850, and it basically determined that the Kansas Territory and the Nebraska Territory would become slave states or free states by popular vote. So lots of abolitionists from New England went out to the Kansas Territory so that they could increase the population of anti-slaver abolitionists, and Lawrence was their capital. And it's of course, the site of a great university, the University of Kansas, and which still maintains that sort of abolitionist and liberty-defending tradition.
So the next day, Sunday, on the campaign trail in Iowa, Elizabeth Warren made headlines by by answering a question to I think it was a CNN reporter, saying that by the time we get to 2020, Donald Trump may not even be president. And then she went on to say, in fact, he may not even be a free person. She defended that by basically saying, well, you know, haven't you noticed the news lately? How many investigations are going on? So is she going to continue that tack? Because, you know, I've been saying for the longest time that Trump is not only a criminal but a traitor. And that's based upon endless conversations with people in the intelligence world who have all the facts. And an enormous number of books have uncovered Trump's seedy business past, along with, of course, his long and disgraceful relationship with Russian organized crime and then with the KGB.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's hard to tell whether she'll continue to talk about that, but it wouldn't be altogether surprising if she did. I mean, first of all, it is salient, right? It's being talked about in the news a great deal. Second of all, it's not sort of baselessly being talked about in the news a great deal. I mean, what seems to be coming out is all sorts of evidence to the effect that various investigations that are underway might very well be on to criminal violations. Now, again, we won't know until these investigations are completed, but, I mean, you know, given how many people who are so close to Mr. Trump are actually now being indicted, there's really not much higher to go, you might say, in the hierarchy or in the chain than him himself. And given that, right, it's at least plausible to suggest that that there might indeed be criminal charges brought. So it would be, you know, not a baseless thing to say. And then finally, thirdly, I mean, the way he keeps taunting her with these ridiculous sort of racist taunts, you know, it's a miracle, I think, that she's even as patient as she is. I would have thought that she would have, you know, gone to the mattresses much earlier, given the, you know, completely sort of out of bounds ways in which he attacks her, just like everybody else who he ever attacks.
Well, he obviously is a racist. I mean, he started his campaign with a racial attack on Mexicans, and now he's shut down the government once to get his wall, which is entirely a product of racism and delusion and whipping up white anxiety about, you know, a kind of the cultural dilution coming from the South, the same kind of stuff that Orban talks about in Hungary. So there's no mystery there. But what do you – you know, I watched the Elizabeth Warren's opening announcement of the presidency, and she seems like she's – I mean, we know that she's extremely bright. You know, well, I've had some email exchanges with her, but I haven't really met her in person. And she strikes me as being really smart, perhaps to the point of it being detrimental, and I'm not sure about this. Let me run it by you. On the one hand, she's clearly very, very schooled in economics and particularly in consumer finance, et cetera, and stuff that she's championed in terms of reforms. But she's not slick like a politician, and that's not necessarily a virtue. So how do you think it's going to play in her being more, I'd say, more academic than political?
So it's hard to say. I mean, she's an interesting combination, right? I mean, I think her basic vibe as a person is very sort of Harry Truman-esque, right? I think her gut instinct, in other words, is for the little guy. Her gut instinct is to be sort of feistily indignant on behalf of the little guy who's been sort of shafted by an economy that has come increasingly to be sort of rigged against little folk. Even if it weren't intended to be rigged in that way, it has ended up being rigged, right? Even if we were, in other words, to be sort of charitable in our interpretations as to how things got to the point that they are, I think we would still have to admit that it's rigged against them, whether it was intended or not. And that makes her quite indignant, as in the same way that Harry Truman was. Now, in that sense, right, she doesn't seem like an academic alone. I mean, she seems like a kind of classic populist firebrand, but not of the kind of obnoxious type like Orban, or the sort of racist type like Orban, or as Trump seems to be, but rather of, you know, the kind of closer to the Huey P. Long type, right, who really cares about the constituents, right? On the other hand, you're right. I mean, she's been in an academic milieu for a long time, partly because she is so super smart. She, as I remember, she's one of the first, if not the first, I think, in her immediate family to have gone even to college. Maybe I might be wrong about that, so don't hold me to it. But I don't think that I don't think everybody in her background family were all, you know, sort of college educated folk. So she's very proud, justly, and her family has been very proud, justly, of her academic accomplishments. And you know, she started in Oklahoma, going to a community college. Then when she went to law school, she went to Rutgers. I mean, she wasn't some, you know, sort of elite type. She just, by sheer brilliance and determination, you know, worked her way up to the very top, where she became a very distinguished Harvard law professor, even though that's not where she started. So there is all of that, and that means that she doesn't tend to be, you know, a kind of mud wrestler type, you might say, as some politicians are, thank God. But she is thoughtful, and she is cerebral, and there is this current in American politics, happily not dominant, but sometimes ascendant, that's kind of anti-intellectual, right? I guess it was Douglas Hofstetter who first wrote about that, right? The anti-intellectual style in American politics.
Right. Well, it was Donald Trump who said, "I love the poorly educated." So yes. The question would be, is do you think with this that she could be a welcome break from the current morass of anti-intellectualism that's taken over this country?
I think she could. I think she's sort of optimally situated to be that, precisely because of what I mentioned before, that she is on the one hand quite intellectual and quite thoughtful and just super smart and super well-educated and very distinguished. But on the other hand, she really is that kind of Harry Truman sort of tough, egalitarian battler. And that, you know, her background is reflected in that, right? She grew up in Oklahoma, not that far away from Independence, Missouri, where Harry Truman grew up. That's sort of her part of the country. That's where she still has the accent, of course, as you can tell when she speaks. She doesn't talk like a Boston Brahmin from Harvard. She talks like an Oklahoman because that's what she is. So in that sense, I think she's a really hopeful case for us, right? She combines those two things.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School and a fellow at Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, the Occupy Cooperative, and he recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act, and he's currently the public finance advisor to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and helped write the Green New Deal. So you had to defend the Green New Deal, at least the right-wing version of it, which had been cherry-picked from old drafts long since discarded. But of course, the Fox News people are not interested in facts and news. They're only interested in propaganda and dogma. So, how did you think your heated exchange with Tucker Carlson went? And because they usually put liberals on to kind of ridicule them, but you stood your ground, you know, which you didn't come across like the usual liberal sacrificial goat, which is what Fox News does when they bring on people that they disagree with.
Yeah, so I felt. Okay, right immediately afterwards, but then later on, I felt a little badly about it because it was sort of an odd thing, right? As it turned out, we were both thinking about two distinct documents. Tucker Carlson seems to have been referring to one document, the existence of which I didn't know about at the time. I had recently read a tweet from the Congresswoman herself about a fake document. So once Tucker mentioned things that aren't in the Green New Deal itself, I sort of assumed he must be talking about that fake document that the Congresswoman had tweeted about. It turns out he was actually talking about a different document that apparently maybe some members of the office sent out inadvertently, some sort of an early draft that wasn't meant to go out. So on the one hand, I was glad that I stood my ground, and I was glad that I made really clear that the Green New Deal itself and the resolution contains none of these nonsensical things that were mentioned. On the other hand, I did feel badly because I made it look as though he was talking about something that didn't exist, whereas indeed it looks as though it might very well have existed. And so in a sense, right, we were both talking about different things. I think the proverbial bottom line here is really ultimately we shouldn't have been talking about either of those two things because those are not the Green Deal resolution, right? The Green Deal resolution is the thing that anybody can find on the web right now, signed on to by some 70 members of the House and close to 9 members of the Senate, somewhere around there, and of course, including most of the Democratic presidential candidates. So, you know, I wish we could have talked about the Green New Deal itself that evening. And of course, that's what I've been doing since then and hope to be doing, you know, going forward. It's been a very exciting several days. I've done a lot of radio and TV today, actually, on the Green New Deal. And of course, a lot last week. It's a very exciting initiative.
Well, of course, you know, I would hate people to read first drafts of things that I've written. I think it's only fair to judge things on the final draft and what made the cut, you know. But
I sort of analogized it to you know, Joyce's Ulysses, right? I mean, even literary critics will talk about Ulysses itself before they turn to discarded drafts or pirated editions, you know. So right. Hopefully we'll talk about Ulysses from now on, you know.
So back to Elizabeth Warren, since you know her well, does she have a foreign policy? If she does, I'm not particularly aware of it. So enlighten me if you can.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think I can't really definitively or sort of authoritatively speak about what her foreign policy views or plans are, but I can say a little bit about what I think her instincts and gut is, and then of course ultimately it'll be for her office itself to sort of talk about the specifics. But
sure.
My impression in general of the senator is that her egalitarian sort of tendencies and her tendency to want to sort of fight for or stick up for the little guy or the disadvantaged person carries over, right, to global relations as well. So I think what that means is she doesn't want the United States to act like a bully, but she also isn't somebody who's going to shrink in the face of other bullies, right? She can be quite feisty when she realizes that a wrong is being done or a wrong is being threatened. And I think what that means ultimately, she wants to make very certain that the United States is not acting in the wrong or isn't bullying or exploiting others or throwing its weight around. But by the same token, I don't think that she will hesitate to stand up and denounce and actually work to counteract any sort of bullying that might be being done by anybody else, right? Just as she is against Wall Street bank bullies, I think she would be against imperialistic bullies or authoritarian bullies or what have you. That would be my guess.
But do you think that she could extend her remarks in terms of Trump not even being a free person in 2020 to that discussion? Because it's so obvious that Trump he likes dictators. We're going to be talking about it in a few minutes. He's covering up him and Netanyahu, the only two people in the world that are covering up for Mohammed bin Salman. We know Trump is incredibly transactional. There's got to be if he's doing such a huge favor, sticking his neck out for this guy, I imagine that Trump's getting something in return. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, his cabinet is a team of grifters. And his foreign policy is a love fest for dictators and kleptocrats and nothing but disdain and abuse for our traditional democratic allies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I think two of her most foundational sort of instincts, I mean, two things that I mean are just visceral with her are a complete loathing and contempt for bullying or, you know, sort of authoritarianism of any kind, right? Any kind of bullying or throwing weight around or, you know, sort of trampling on the rights or the prerogatives or the concerns or the interests or even just the lives of others, number one. And number two, I think, is she just absolutely loathes and feels just unfathomable contempt for corruption of any kind, right? Any sort of back backroom dealings or under-the-table sorts of dealings where you're subverting established processes that have been democratically determined that are meant themselves to manifest democratic values. Any subversion of processes like this with this kind of, you know, under-the-table type stuff or being, quote-unquote, transactional in the way that Trump is supposedly is, I think just horrifies her, right? I'm sort of happy that we use that word on the one hand because it's much more sort of polite sounding. On the other hand, it is kind of a euphemism, isn't it?
Right.
Don Corleone was transactional, right?
Right. But that's, I think, just in closing there, Robert, that's the point. I think that if she keeps saying it like it is and without being crude and disgraceful like Trump, not going in the gutter, but really, really nailing this guy for mm-hmm. who he is, and using mm-hmm. not rough language, but you know, sharply honed stern language. That would be really refreshing because I'm just sick of everybody equivocating about this guy and treating him like a normal person and a normal president. And I
love that she's so straight talking, just like Truman. Again, she calls a spade a spade. I mean, she's,
right.
she's
well,
not going
to well,
you know.
Tell her to keep it up, okay? And thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thank you, Ian. Thanks so much, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell Law School and a fellow at the Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, and the Occupy Cooperative. And he's recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act, and he's currently the public finance advisor to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and helped write the Green New Deal. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into why Trump and Netanyahu are going to the mat for Mohammed bin Salman. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Alon Ben-Mir, a professor and senior fellow at New York University Center for Global Affairs and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute, an expert on Middle East politics and affairs, specializing in international negotiations and conflict resolution. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Alon Ben-Mir.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
So,
anytime.
In the exchanges since Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, wrote this extraordinarily explosive blog post, essentially outing himself to get ahead of the AMI or the publisher of the National Enquirer, their lawyers have written back to him saying American media emphatically rejects any assertion that its reporting was instigated, dictated, or influenced in any manner by external forces, political or otherwise. And Bezos, in his blog post, hinted rather tantalizingly, saying, for reasons still to be better understood, the Saudi angle seems to hit a particularly sensitive nerve. And he was referring to the head of AMI, David Pecker, being apoplectic at the idea that investigators for Jeff Bezos were looking into Saudi Arabia's possible role in outing him and bringing about his divorce. So any clues to what Jeff Bezos is talking about, Dr. Ben-Mir?
Well, Jeff Bezos has been a target of the Saudis since the assassination, or there's actually the butchering, I should say, of the journalist Khashoggi at the in Ankara's in Istanbul Turkish Saudi embassy.
Consulate.
because Bezos owns the Washington Post. And the Washington Post reported many times, numerous times, about the murder of Khashoggi and obviously blaming the Saudis for what actually happened there. So for the Saudis, Bezos was never, was a target. And obviously they have capitalized on anything that the American media was able to provide to them. And that's really what it was all about. The actual, where the stories actually came from, emanate from, there's no clear evidence today, but there's no question the MI played a very significant role in that regard. And they are also, particularly because they were negotiating with the Saudis to make a deal on their own and in connection with the purchase of the magazine?
The National Enquirer. You're talking about the glossy magazine that they manufactured?
They have produced that, but yeah. They also were interesting. The MI was interested to buy the Times, actually.
Oh, I see.
Times. Yeah, and this, the Saudis promised they would be able to finance that. So there's some kind of collusion, I would say, between the Saudis and American media. This is what actually happened, and I think Bezos is... in between, because Saudis have interest in undermining him in every which way they can. American media might have been able to provide them with the kind of stories and the photos that's been involved. And that is really what actually happened.
Well, the Daily Beast is reporting that the brother of the girlfriend of Jeff Bezos, Lauren Sanchez, her brother, apparently is the source, at least most people seem to think he's the source of the information that appeared in terms of but there's also a lot of reporting coming out of the Middle East, coming particularly from the Emirates, about a group of ex-NSA people who were hired by Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ as he's referred to, is often considered to be a mentor of MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi Crown Prince. And that has led a lot of people to suggest that there's maybe some Saudi, Emirati hacking involved. I'm trying to follow that. Have you heard anything to that effect?
Well, it is possible that the brothers actually was the conduit for that. This is a sort of ongoing developing conspiracy, so to speak, between all these various players. But the truth of the matter is that this whole episode really is one big scheme to continue to cover up for the murder, the butchering of Khashoggi. And anyone who is reviving this issue of the murder is being a target of the Saudis. And as I said, I think from my perspective, I see that the ownership of the Washington Post by Bezos is one of the instigator that's behind this, what the Saudis are trying to undermine him in every which way they can, and been given the information they were looking for, then they had an opportunity to do that in collusion with the American media.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Alon Ben-Mir, a professor and a senior fellow at the New York University's Center for Global Affairs and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute, an expert on Middle East politics and affairs. He specializes in international negotiations and conflict resolution. Now, one of the ironies, Dr. Ben-Mir, about the Bezos bombshell was it was dropped on the same day that the CIA leaked information of a previous intercept of Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, talking to an aide or a friend or somebody, saying that he'd like to put a bullet in Khashoggi. So that's pretty ironic, explosive, almost as explosive. And what an irony that Bezos drowned out that story.
And there's no question. I think this is no coincidence. It's actually, they probably took a page from Trump himself. When there's something terrible or bad news about him, he drops another shoe. He says something else to distract the attention of the public from the other problem. So this is almost natural. What happened? They wanted to bury the whole issue of Khashoggi. And they were without going to any length to try to do that. And the question is why the United States, actually I should say the Trump administration, is continued to cover up for all of this. And notwithstanding, of course, the intelligence communities report that, in fact, they found the MBS, that is the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, to be actually behind 100%. And this is, I think, this is really the bigger picture. Why is Trump is actually doing what he's doing, saying what he's doing? And to this day, he's actually was supposed to report last Friday about the final findings about who behind the killing. And the Friday came in and out, and no report, even though he was required to report to Congress about what actually happened. So you know, you have an administration who is very supportive of the Saudis. The Saudis are doing everything they can in order to buy as much influence as they humanly possible. They were working with the American media to undertake a massive new public relation campaign to endear Mohammed bin Salman in the eyes of American public and etc. So this whole thing is going on, and Bezos was caught in the middle because of his reporting on what actually been happening.
So why then is President Donald Trump defying his own intelligence services, who told him that Mohammed bin Salman was behind the murder and dismemberment of Khashoggi? The UN recently came out with a report to that. You just mentioned the Senate Foreign Relations Committee sent a letter to the White House in October with a deadline of Friday.
That's right.
And he's ignored that deadline. He's also, the rest of the world leaders, just about everybody, has also come out. So something's going on here. Why is President Trump going to the mat for Mohammed bin Salman?
Well, you know, honestly, I think at least 5, 6, 7 reasons I can think of off the bat. First of all, his personal deals. Trump has, notwithstanding his denials, extensive businesses still there. So this is, we have to keep that in mind. Then you have the very close relationship, you might say, between Mohammed bin Salman and Kushner. They developed this relationship in Kushner's effort to try to develop some kind of so-called deal of the century. So in the interim, this relationship evolved and became the Bingham friendly. And Trump wants to maintain that because that also gives him certain kind of leverage. The other thing is, you know, Saudi Arabia has been against Iran, the United States is against Iran. Saudi Arabia has been helpful in that regard, and they do not want, and as long as they have Saudi against Iran, it's for the, that served Trump's interest in this regard. Then you have the Saudis being helpful to some extent in trying, and basically the Saudis promised they would put all the necessary pressure on Abbas, on the Palestinian, to get them to accept the so-called deal of the century when the time comes. So, but also they have been the conduit of bringing the Gulf state much closer to Israel, which is very, very significant. This was something that Netanyahu really priced very high for him. This was very important. And so that Netanyahu put a lot of, made his own effort to in the White House to make sure that this Khashoggi issue will not disrupt the process that's been taking place. And so he played also a role in that regard, and Trump worked with him on that issue. That is keeping Saudi Arabia close, supportive of the process going on, specifically opening the door for Israel and the Gulf state. The other point I should mention is arms sales. There's no question. I don't think Saudi Arabia buying $110 billion worth of arms, but certainly in the many billions are still buying. And for Trump, this is another something that he wants to brag about. And albeit it is dollars, it does translate to dollars as far as the arm manufacturing here in the United States. And then there's also the United, you know, Trump is looking for more U.S. Saudi investment in this country. So when you look at all of these issues put together, you see that Trump, notwithstanding the intelligence findings, he really couldn't care less. And what else is new? He's been attacking the intelligence community from day one. And this is just a continuation of the same attitude that is assumed almost from day one.
And I should have also mentioned that he's defying the overwhelming resolution of the United States Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, who said that MBS is behind the murder of Khashoggi. So when you mentioned Trump's likely business dealings, which, of course, there's no transparency. We haven't even seen his tax returns. Is it also likely that Jared Kushner has business dealings? Somebody bailed out 666 Fifth Avenue.
There's no question. I mean, I know from certain sources as well that Kushner actually was, when he could not get funding someplace else, he actually turned to Russia at one point, but the Saudis is more amenable. And this is one of the reasons, you know, he became also very close to MBS, the crown prince. So Kushner does have also a financial interest in there. I say when you look at it, you know, have Netanyahu on the one hand, you have the dream of having the deal of the century on the other, you have the Kushner's interest, you have a Trump interest, you have arms sales, you have the Iran, you have the peace process. All of this put together creative, a situation where for Trump, why should he sacrifice all of that or undermine it? Only because we have to be on the right side of history. Trump doesn't have that much moral focus to make that kind of judgment. So this is where we are right now, and which is unfortunate.
Well, but normally you have nation-to-nation dealings. It looks as if we have family-to-family dealings here, the Trump family and the Salman family. And I'm wondering why both Netanyahu, I don't attribute a great deal of diplomatic and political understanding to Donald Trump, but Netanyahu's been a pretty savvy player in that neighborhood. Why is he sticking with MBS and this idea that he alone can bring off this great new peace deal with Jared Kushner? There are many, many princes in Saudi Arabia. He's just one prince. He is not Saudi Arabia.
Well, he is the crown prince, however. I mean, he will be, he's the de facto king today.
Right.
His father is not well at all. Mm. And he's the de facto king, and there will be the king. And there's no any group or princesses or prince of any, you know, who is, you know, not a single one really who is challenging him or will be able to challenge him. He will be the king, albeit he's already the de facto king. But for Netanyahu, it's not really a salvaging the peace process, the so-called deal of the century. For Netanyahu, is actually making Israel much closer to the Arab world, specifically the Gulf states. Oman was open. I know for sure there were conversations were happening with many top officials, Saudis, Bahrainis, Qataris, meeting with Israelis just the same. So for Netanyahu, it's not as much the deal, because he really does not want this deal. I know for sure, because I've had many opportunities to speak about this, and they are not interested. Netanyahu is not interested in the deal, but he's interested in what the process has created to bring the Arab world much closer to Israel. But it's also precipitated because of the fact that Iran is a threat to Israel, and it's a threat to Saudi Arabia and to the Gulf states. So there is... The old statement, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. This is what we are witnessing today. So Netanyahu has been working very closely with Trump on this particular issue, and this is what we are witnessing today. And I don't think any much would really change.
Right, but does Netanyahu not recognize Mohammed bin Salman as damaged goods, which the U.S. Senate does, the CIA does, most of the Western European countries do?
But damaged goods to whom? For whom? That's the question. Uh-huh. The Saudis now making, as I said earlier, a supreme effort to improve its image in the West. There is no real rival or substitute for him at this juncture, to say the least, in Saudi Arabia.
That's because he's got rid of them all, right, or put them in jail.
Well, yeah, definitely in part is that as well.
Right.
So, and the murder, I mean, just think in those terms, Saudi Arabia to this day, the death penalty is by beheading. So for the Saudis, killing one journalist in however for a atrocious way it happened, it's really not a big deal for them. It is a big deal for us, obviously. But if you have an administration, a president, who is willing to accept that at face, you know, they told him he's denying, just like we said, standing next to Putin and say, well, you know, I asked Putin if there was any collusion. He denied that categorically, so I have no reason not to trust him, not to believe him. You have a president here who has sold his soul long time ago. He's got, you know, there's no morals. Trump has no zero morals here. And so he's going by his guts. He does what he wants to do. And for him, Saudi Arabia is an important partner for the many reasons I just mentioned to you. And there's no way we can judge any of this based on moral grounds. There are no moral grounds. Netanyahu, too, does not really have any strong moral grounds to stand on. But that's the real politics of today, which is sad and tragic for that matter.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, is it possible, and I've heard this from a number of sources, that as much as we talk about collusion or possible collusion between the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, and Russia, is it equally possible that Saudi Arabia and the Trump campaign also colluded?
I don't know if they colluded, but certainly money did flow to the campaign. We know that for sure, a lot of money. And that is going to be eventually revealed also by the one, if and when the Mueller investigation becomes public. So that money did flow, and that's part of it. I'm also told that Saudi money was involved in various projects, here in the United States that Trump has, including the hotel in Washington. So there's all kind, you know, the Saudis been very much, but their purse was pretty much open. When it came to Trump, even before he became president, let alone at this juncture, so there are a lot of things under the table, so to speak. Much of it, I think, and I hope actually to be revealed, once the Mueller investigation comes to light, and even hopefully sooner than that, once the income tax which is the name of the committee, the mm-hmm. congressional committee has demanded that.
Yeah, House Oversight, Ways and Means, yes.
The Ways and Means Committee demanded that his tax return.
Sure.
And they have the power to, the IRS doesn't have really a choice. They have to submit that. It would be a challenge, but I think eventually we're going to see that. And all of these financial shenanigans that have taken place is going to be revealed. I hope, in any event, that's going to be the case. We are in, I said last year, 2018 was very turbulent here as far as our domestic politics internationally goes. But 2019, I said just 2 months ago, is going to be considerably more traumatic, more turbulent than 2018 by far. And I think so far, it is so.
Well, Dr. Alon Ben Meir, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Many times. My pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Alon Ben Meir, who's a professor and a senior fellow at New York University Center for Global Affairs and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute, an expert on Middle East politics and affairs. He specializes in international negotiations and conflict resolution. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking at Iran 40 years after the revolution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Abbas Milani, who's a director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project, and until 1986, taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he's also a member of the board of directors of the university's Center for International Relations. And he's the author of The Shah. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abbas Milani.
Thank you for having me.
And we're speaking, Abbas, on the today being the 40th anniversary of the 1979 revolution. So you were there, and my understanding is that people were extremely hopeful of a new, free, democratic Iran.
I think that's true. I think it was a moment of jubilation. I think the great majority of the people were overjoyed that they thought a new democratic page is going to be turned. I think the view was that the dream of the constitutional revolution, which had happened in Iran 1905, 1907, and was about creating a government responsive to people, where people are sovereign and the laws are derived from the will of the people, is going to be finally realized. That joy was short-lived when they realized that a clerical authoritarian regime is going to replace the monarchy.
Well, they got a theocracy instead of a democracy, and they got a theocracy led by a cleric who poses as God's representative on earth. I mean, you know, the Pope is supposed to be infallible to Catholics, but most Catholics don't necessarily believe he's infallible. But Ayatollah Khamenei, he believes. I mean, isn't that the system that he's the 12th Imam?
He's not the 12th Imam. The 12th Imam, according to the Iranian version of Shiism. Again, Shiism is a minority part of Islam. The majority of the Muslims are Sunnis. Some maybe 25% are what are called Shiites. And there are several iterations of Shiism. The Iranian iteration is generally called Isna Ashari, or the Twelvers. They believe that there are 12 Imams, and that the 12th Imam has gone into hiding some 1,000 years ago and is going to emerge, according to Mr. Ahmadinejad, from a dry well about 30 miles outside Tehran, where he has built a great shrine to it. And the Khomeini and Khomeini before him, the theory belongs to Khomeini, actually the founder of the regime, claims that he and his successor are the representatives of that 12th Imam. So they are the representatives of the 12th Imam, but you're absolutely right that many times the regime's advocates have said that standing up to Mr. Khomeini is like standing up to God and is a form of heresy.
But my understanding is that Iran today, in terms of the social changes, is completely out of step with the rigid moral strictures that Iran's leaders still impose upon the people.
I think that's absolutely true. I think the Iranian society has by far bypassed the regime. You have a regime that a society that, even according to the regime stalwart, has become far more secular than it ever was. The people are far more aware of the need to keep religion and politics separate. The Iranian women, in spite of 40 years of misogyny, are now much more assertive in demanding their rights, in fighting the draconian measures to force everyone to wear a hijab. Women are increasingly defiantly trying to decide their own lives. They don't abide by the regime's policy of early marriage and multiple children. They marry late. They have about 2 children average, and they're very active in the social domain, in the economic life of society, in spite of the regime. They go to colleges in spite of the efforts of the regime to put quotas on them. So I think you're absolutely right. There is an entirely different Iran, pulsating under this facade of septuagenarian misogynist men who want society to live by rules that they think they have developed from the ways of the Prophet 1,400 years ago.
So it's not just that people are chafing under the strictures of a theocracy. They're also, and this goes back to the Shah's days, there's also this cronyism where the Shah took care of his people and in a patronage system. And now you have a bunch of rich mullahs living in North Tehran in the former homes of the Shah's people, do you not? And, you know, people are demonstrating there, chanting, people are paupers while mullahs live like gods.
Well, I think the fact that there are increasing differences between the very rich, which are almost all either clerics' sons, and Revolutionary Guard commanders. There is a complete new class of nouveau riche that have absolutely remarkable wealth. There are videos about the rich boys of Tehran that you can go online and see. They're embarrassingly rich and unabashed about showing off their wealth. And you have a majority of society that lives in very, very dire circumstances. The currency has fallen compared to the Shah's time. For example, when the Shah left, the dollar brought you 7 tuman. Today, you need to pay 10,000 at least, between 10,000 to 12,000 to get $1. If you had $1, you could buy something like 10. The average income of a worker in Iran at the time would allow you to buy something like 40 kilos of meat a month. Now that is down to about less than 4 kilos. So there is a drastic fall in the standard of living for the poor and an embarrassing, obnoxious increase in the riches of the children of the clergy themselves, the children of the Revolutionary Guards. You know, there is a study that shows that over the last 40 years, every major executive position in the government has been held by 2,300 and about 30 men. And I say about because there's a handful of women who never have had a higher position. There's been one minister, a few deputy ministers, no presidents, no judges of the highest authority, a handful of members of the parliament. So you have absolutely a male-dominated society, and this 2,300, which are all connected with one another, they're married with one another, and invariably at the highest level of these families, you will find a cleric who is reaping the riches while the people are suffering increasingly. And in the last year, one of the most important developments has been that the demonstrations against the regime have moved away from being demonstrations of only the urban middle class or some of the urban working class to primarily the poor working class, and then primarily in small cities that used to be the bastions of this regime. That, I think, is the major challenge facing this regime. They are losing their most important social base. They claim to be the regime of the Mustazaf, which literally means the poor. And now the Mustazaf, the poor, are increasingly militantly demanding better pay, demanding their pay. I mean, we have workers who haven't been paid for 7 months, and they're demonstrating, asking for simple payment of their back to wages.
So, but the U.S. is adding to the pain because of the ramped up sanctions, which Donald Trump, of course, ran against the Obama deal. And he's ramped up sanctions. He's doing the same thing, actually, in Venezuela, too, on the theory that somehow by punishing the government, the people will rise up and get rid of the government. But the sanctions actually punish the people, not the government.
I think this. I agree. I mean, I'm not an expert on Venezuela, but in the case of Iran, I think the way that Mr. Trump withdrew from the deal and the increased sanctions, unilateral sanctions, have basically put more pressure on the Iranian economy. That's for sure. Although he claims that he has put all the pressure, which is, I think, very much an exaggeration. He has exacerbated what was there already. The Iranian economy was in a crisis because the problems are structural, but the sanctions have increased that problem. But they have also allowed the regime to find a scapegoat for its own incompetence, for its own cronyism, for its own corruption. They now try to blame everything on the sanctions. They keep talking about how it's the sanctions that is causing all of these difficulties. Now, whether the Iranian people will buy it or not is an open question, but it has given the conservatives, the most conservative elements of the regime, a new out, a new legitimizing narrative for the crisis that is absolutely the result of their cronyism, their incompetence, and their corruption.
So you did a biography on the Shah's longest-serving prime minister, and there are reports from Iran that there's a kind of nostalgia for the Shah. Is it possible that they could be, they could be wanting the Shah back? I mean, I can't imagine why, but is there any? I know the royalists are still out there. Living in exile, like the Romanovs lived in exile forever, but I would think it. You know, wouldn't it long last the cry from the Iranian people if indeed they can get rid of these horrible mullahs and all these Revolutionary Guards guys and the besieged militia, all of whom have the guns and are oppressing them? Wouldn't they want democracy? What are these reports about nostalgia for the Shah?
Well, you know, we don't have polls. All of these things are completely anecdotal. Both the regime in Iran and some of the royalists outside would like to pretend like all of the demonstrations are nostalgic and driven by the United States, paid for by Saudi Arabia. This is not true. Is there nostalgia for the Shah? Absolutely, I think there is. Does the Shah's regime fare far more favorably compared to this regime on every account, from cronyism to corruption to oppression? Absolutely. I mean, these people, by their misbehavior, have created the absolute fertile ground for the kind of nostalgia that you refer to. But my sense is that the people want democracy in Iran. They want democratic change. And they want to be the masters of their own fate. They're not going to, I think, look favorably.
Sure. Well, Abbas, we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Abbas Milan, who's the Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and Professor of the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.